This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. Welcome to the program.
And if you're listening to this broadcast, tomorrow is tax day, so it's possible that many of you still have all those financial documents gathered together and close to hand. So you should have, at this point, I think, a fairly clear picture of your family's financial situation, what type of accounts you have, where they're located, what they're invested in, what types of income you have. And I'm sure by now, after talking to your accountant, what your tax rates are going to be, and especially as they apply to income. Now, last week, Kathleen and I discussed the various tax rates that apply to different types of investment income. Interest income is taxed differently than dividend income or capital gains. And in the first half of this week's program, we're going to tease out a little bit more why paying attention to tax rates on various types of income really can make a substantial difference, especially when you're in retirement.
And for the second half of today's program, Jim's going to tackle an issue that faces a growing number of us, unfortunately, which is cancer. Now, the American Cancer Society estimates that at the end of 2012, there were roughly 14 million Americans living who were either currently battling cancer or were in remission from a past battle with cancer. That's a lot of people. And statistically, almost 1,600 people die a day from cancer. Right now, roughly one out of every four deaths in the U.S. is attributed to cancer. So it's obviously something of great concern to us as a populace. Now, most of us, I think, are probably pretty familiar with traditional treatments for cancer. Surgery, there's photon radiation therapy, chemotherapy, etc. But there's also another newer technology, proton therapy, that's gaining some traction in the cancer treatment world. So today, Jim and his guest, Lynn Martell, who's the director of special services radiation medicine at nearby Loma Linda University Medical Center, they're going to be talking about this proton therapy cancer treatment alternative.
But before we get started with tax rates and the withdrawal strategies today, I want to address an issue raised by a recent ruling by the U.S. court about IRA rollovers. Now, you may not have heard this. The ruling was that regardless of how many IRAs a taxpayer maintains, he or she may make only one non-taxable rollover contribution within each one-year period. Now, for 20 years, the prevailing wisdom has been that one rollover per year per IRA was the standard. This, folks, is a major game changer. Notice what I'm saying here. That one IRA rollover per IRA was the case. Now they're saying only one IRA rollover for all the IRAs that you have. Doesn't matter if you have 5, 7, 10 IRAs, which is another good reason to talk about consolidation.
Why don't we talk about what exactly is an IRA rollover, Jim? Because I know that a lot of our clients get confused as to, if I'm moving money from Fidelity to you, is that a rollover? What is that? And so what exactly is an IRA rollover so that people don't get themselves stuck in this mess? So an IRA rollover happens when an IRA owner takes money out of their IRA as a distribution. Maybe they get sent a check. Maybe they get sent a wire to their bank account, and they use the money for 60 days. And then after 60 days, they redeposit the money back into that same IRA or a different IRA within that 60-day rollover time frame, so it doesn't count as a taxable distribution. Now, that's an IRA rollover. This is not to be confused with an IRA transfer. Now, you may not be aware of this, but if you have your IRA at a financial institution like a brokerage service or a bank, usually that brokerage service or a bank is what's called a custodian of your IRA. And so if you move your funds from Fidelity to Schwab or from Schwab to E-Trade or what have you, those are not rollovers. Those are transfers between IRA custodians. They're called custodian-to-custodian transfers. So you could move your IRA money from Schwab to E-Trade to Fidelity to any number of different online brokerage services or managed account services. You could do that dozens of times a year and the IRS isn't going to care. They are going to care when you take an actual distribution, do something with it, and then redeposit it back into an IRA. So it's an important distinction to make there so you don't get confused as to what counts as a rollover and what counts as a transfer, because they're different animals.
So I want to move on to now is strategizing your retirement income by the sources, by what effect they're going to have on your taxes. And especially now, since you're probably really focused on what's going on with your taxes. So let's take a look at the various sources of income. You have taxable income that can come from, let's say, a paycheck if you're still working, withdrawals that you're making, assuming you're 59 and a half, you can start taking withdrawals without penalty from, let's say, a simple IRA, a SEP, rollover, or traditional IRAs, and also non-qualified Roth plans, and also any deferred compensation payouts that you may have with the company that you worked for. Now, the sources of partially taxable income, that gets into things like Social Security, depending on the income that you have overall, non-qualified annuity payouts. And then, of course, there's other sources of non-taxable income like Roth IRAs or Roth 401k programs. Every one of them taxed differently.
I think it's important, especially when you start talking about, again, IRAs, to really make that important distinction between the fact that traditional and rollover, SEP, and simple IRA money withdrawals are typically fully taxable for the most part, whereas Roth IRA withdrawals and Roth 401k withdrawals aren't. And something similar happens, again, with annuities, where if you have a qualified annuity contract, like an IRA annuity contract, withdrawals on that are going to be taxable. On a non-qualified annuity contract, maybe your distribution is only partially taxable. So again, good things to talk over with your tax advisor. So if you're thinking about planning a withdrawal strategy from your accounts when you're retired, you want to think about what Jim just discussed, which is the overall broad idea of which of your sources of income are going to be taxed. But what about this whole idea about the investment income? Because sometimes you're going to be drawing money from your investments. So if you're thinking about withdrawing money from a taxable investment account, again, what should you be keeping in mind? Now, overall, there's a 3.8% net investment income tax at certain income tax levels, usually starting around $250,000. That's something to always keep in mind if you're in a high tax bracket. Now, different types of investment income that are taxed like your ordinary income, just like your paycheck, are things like interest income on sources of interest income that are not U.S. Treasuries or municipal bonds. So, for example, corporate bonds, income from corporate bonds taxed at the same rate as your ordinary income from your paycheck. Short-term capital gains, which means anything that you've bought and held for less than a year and then sold for a profit, that's taxed at the same rate as your ordinary income. Now, if you're in a lower tax bracket, if your taxable income falls in the 10% or 15% marginal tax brackets, you're lucky enough that your qualified dividends and that your long-term capital gains are taxed at 0%. So if you're in that particular situation, you're pretty lucky because most of your investment income is going to be taxed at 0%. And regardless of your tax bracket, municipal bond income is taxed at 0%. So what's taxed at 15%? Well, if you're in the tax brackets that fall between 25% and 35%, your long-term capital gains and your qualified dividends are taxed at 15%. Now, what if your investment income is taxed at 20%? Well, if you fall on the highest marginal tax bracket of 39.6%, long-term capital gains and qualified dividends are taxed at that 20% rate. Now, keeping in mind, like we talked about last week, even though capital gains are going to be taxed at higher tax brackets, their taxation rates are still less than your ordinary income. So something to keep in mind when you start to be sensitive about taking capital gains on specific investments and specific gains that you have in your accounts.
Now, when we're talking about, let's say, withdrawals from a typical IRA, a lot of this depends on the size of the overall nest egg and also the amount of taxable assets versus, let's say, tax-deferred assets. And the nest egg ability to sustain throughout retirement is very, very tight. So you really need to look at, for example, your family history of longevity. If you have longevity running in your family, that means you're going to be dependent, especially on your investments over a longer period of time. And it may make sense, depending on your ability to work, how long you're going to work, of maybe delaying Social Security, because each year of delay adds 8% to your full retirement benefit at age 66. And also, your Social Security is a lifetime benefit that won't run out like your assets. So when you're taking a look at making these withdrawals, the mandatory withdrawals that Kathleen talked about that start at age 70 and a half, you really want to look at that, because withdrawals are taxable as ordinary income. And by the way, folks, there's a 50% penalty for failure to meet your required minimum distributions. Now, in one way, this latest IRS ruling that says you're only allowed one rollover per year may in the long run be rather helpful, because we have seen time and time again where individuals have countless IRAs all over the place, and sometimes they end up getting a penalty because they don't realize that their full required minimum distribution is based on the total value of all of their IRAs, not just one or two of them. So traditionally, if you are making those mandatory distributions that start at age 70 and a half, you have to measure what this is going to do, the impact it's going to have on your tax bracket, because they will be going on every single year, and each year that distribution rate will be going up. So you might want to consider supplementing your income in the high, let's say, required mandatory distribution years from, let's say, taking out income that's going to be fully taxable. You may want to start looking at dividend income or tax-free bond income so that you can minimize the impact of those required distributions, because a lot of people get caught up, you know, maybe they're getting Social Security, they're getting a pension, and they really haven't been touching their IRAs. They're just allowing them to accumulate. And then all of a sudden, age 70 and a half, they go see their accountant and say, guess what? You have to take out a required distribution, and this is what the amount is. And all of a sudden, you have a complete tax change in terms of taxability in your overall tax bracket. So you may, around this time of the year, now that you're thinking about taxes right now, start thinking about tax planning, because you still have about another 8 months for the rest of the year to minimize any distribution effects pushing you into a higher tax bracket. This is going to be real key too for a lot of you that are either single, or let's say you're a married couple and you're fortunate enough to be in those higher Obama tax rate brackets that start at $400,000 and $450,000, or let's say that you have a lot of itemized deductions that you can see those phased out or lose 3% of them based on income of $250,000 and $300,000. So this is really the time to really take a serious look and do some planning, because you still have 8.5 months of the year to do some planning. And don't find yourself getting stuck, as we've had a couple cases recently that have come to our attention, of couples that forgot about the Obama tax increases that went into effect January 1st of last year, and all of a sudden they just got whacked either with higher taxes because of the bracket they were in, or they might have been in a lower bracket and they lost 3% of their itemized deductions or a phase out of their personal exemptions.
When we're saving for retirement, we tend to be a lot more conscious of how our decisions as far as what we're contributing to our IRAs or our 401ks, we tend to be a lot more sensitive to how that's going to affect our taxable income. But when we're on the other side of the savings picture, the part where we withdraw, maybe we're not paying as much attention to how our sources of income are affecting our overall tax bracket. And I think what you just pointed out, Jim, that if you have a required minimum distribution that's going to put you in a fairly high tax bracket, or maybe it's going to put you right on the edge of a higher tax bracket, but you still need some additional income, you know, you were pointing out that maybe you can find that income from other types of investments that are taxed in a lower way, like the long-term gains or the dividends or municipal bond income. So it just occurred to me, Jim, that really we're so aware and so hypersensitive to ways to reduce our taxable income before retirement, but there are ways to keep it lower in retirement as well. And that's kind of what we're getting on here. You know, Jim, you were mentioning about pulling money from other certain types of investment income that's got a lower taxation rate than your withdrawals from your IRAs, for example. Just want to point out here in passing that typically speaking, distributions from Roth IRAs and Roth 401ks are not taxable because you paid the tax on those contributions up front before you made the contribution. So if you're thinking about reducing your taxable income, you can certainly consider pulling money out of your Roth IRAs or Roth 401ks. On the other hand, those are pretty great investments to keep growing over the long term, especially if you're planning on passing on some assets to your family. Roth IRAs can be a very good way to do that for folks just because of the tax benefits that they have.
And it's also a time when you're thinking about doing some tax planning. Maybe you're adjusting your portfolio to take advantage of, let's say, tax advantage investments. It's a good time to start thinking about those areas of your portfolio that might have been overweighted. Maybe you were fortunate enough to get into the stock market at the bottom in 2009 and you've seen tremendous gains in your account. Or maybe you've been overinvested in precious metals, cash, or even the bond market. You might want to think about taking a look at some alternatives and taking money or going after those areas that are overweighted in your portfolio. Because the one thing that we've learned in this kind of market is you do want to have a diversified portfolio. So when you have a market like we've had this year where it's kind of like two steps forward, two steps backward, given the fact that we're doing this recording on a Friday where the market's back in negative territory, it seems like we've been up 2%, down 2%. It's pretty much the way we've gone all year since the beginning of January. But it's also a time to take a look at strategically areas of your portfolio that can be repositioned perhaps to produce higher income or reduce your tax liabilities. And folks, this is really the time to do your planning. Don't wait till November and December and you make that call to your accountant. He says, oh, by the way, we're really going to have to bump up your fourth quarter estimates here based on your capital gains or what your taxable income is, or to make up for the fact that you're taking a required distribution that you have to make at the end of the year.
I think it's also just a good idea to think about this, Jim, in terms of planning ahead, which is, you know, when you're thinking about looking at your overall portfolio, doing some repositioning, I know it makes people nervous to dip into their principal when they're in retirement. By the same token, like you were mentioning, if you've had some sizable gains in a particular area, maybe it's time to liquidate those gains, rebalance your portfolio, and take those gains in the form of income into your, you know, your family coffer to sort of bump up what you've got going on from other sources of income. So it's okay to touch your principal in retirement, but again, very strategic planning you should do with your tax advisor in terms of how much you might want to dip into your principal. Now, Jim and I have been giving some pretty broad pieces of information about what types of assets you should tap into in retirement and what type of tax brackets they involve. Now, all of you out there, your situations are completely different from each other. So really just encourage you to consult with your own individual tax advisor and investment advisor before you set up a withdrawal plan. And the second thing we'd suggest too is that you consider meeting with your tax advisor right after you've filed your prior year tax returns to start doing some estimating and calculating and planning for the coming tax year to make sure that your withdrawal strategy for the coming tax year makes sense given what's going to be required for you in terms of withdrawals over the coming tax year. So since your sources of income change from year to year, especially in retirement, it's a good idea to do some strategic tax planning. As Jim was mentioning, do that now rather than waiting till the end of the year to do that. So again, think about setting up a follow-up meeting with your tax advisor after tax day is over to do some strategic planning for next tax year.
And while you're in retirement, probably one of your biggest expenses and sometimes one of your most unpredictable expenses is likely to be the cost of your health care, particularly if you have an illness that is expensive to treat like cancer. There are more treatment options today than there were decades ago. And we're going to be talking with Lynn Martell. He's Director of Special Services of Radiation Medicine at Loma Linda University Medical Center. And I will talk about one of those new treatment options called proton therapy. And one of the reasons I want to talk about this is cancer being next to heart disease, one of the leading cause of death in the U.S., but especially with men and women, each year we have literally tens of thousands of men that die of prostate cancer, women of breast cancer. And if you use early forms of detection, they're treatable and without a lot of side effects. And this really struck me with prostate cancer for men. And it got me last year, two of my favorite authors. I love geopolitical novels. And two of my favorite authors were Vince Flynn and Tom Clancy. And it was unusual that both of them passed away within 6 weeks of each other, Clancy in his mid-60s and Vince Flynn in his mid-40s, a very, very young man. And I thought, how could people like Clancy and Vince Flynn, be so intelligent and let this disease go undetected, because we all know about the importance of going in for an annual checkup every year, the importance of that, but then all of a sudden to have something like this go undetected. So I'm going to be talking about that with Lynn Martell coming up right after this. Every year, over 29,000 men will die of prostate cancer. Each year, over 233,000 new cases of prostate cancer are diagnosed. One out of seven men will be diagnosed during their lifetime, and six out of ten after age 65. It's the second leading cause of death. And there are a number of ways that you can cure prostate cancer. One of them is a very innovative way. It's called proton beam therapy. Joining me is Dr. Lynn Martell. He's Director of Special Services of Radiation Medicine at Loma Linda University. Doctor, let's talk about the disease itself. Why is this so common with men today? I read the statistic. Once you get to age 65, 6 out of 10 will be diagnosed during their lifetime. What's the cause of this, do you think?
Being born a man is one of the factors that's going to lead to prostate cancer. Almost all men, by the time they hit 75 or 80, are going to have some form of the disease. The older they get, the more prominent it's going to become. Prostate cancer is really very easily treatable. It's a matter of kind of watching trends. The PSA is only one, but one of many indicators. And as a PSA trend begins going up, even a 0.75% can indicate that something's going on. So a man needs to be, by the time he's 50, unless he's had some other people in the background that have had prostate cancer, begin monitoring it in the late 40s, early 50s. If a man has had a brother and a father that's had prostate cancer, he probably needs to start in the early 40s, because there's a direct relationship. It seems like when a man has it, his sons end up getting it or an uncle gets it, and that's another indicating factor that you need to kind of monitor it and watch it. But prostate cancer is very easily treatable if you catch it early. There are many, many different modalities out there to treat the cancer, and most of them are quite successful in treating the cancer. The big difference is going to be in the side effects, and we can talk about it later, but that's where proton makes all the difference in the world in terms of the minimal side effects.
Doctor, why is it that we're seeing more cases of it today? Is it because we have better detection in terms of medical advancements? Is it because men are living longer? But I guess you didn't hear much about this, let's say, 100 years ago. Is this a 21st century disease?
Well, I don't think it's a 20th century. I think men probably have always had it. It's far more prominent now is because people are much more aware of it. There's more sophisticated testing going on. And I think men in general are being tested more frequently. And as there's an awareness there in the public to go about the testing, then people begin to identify it. I think it's always been out there. It's just that it's more prominent because there's more of awareness of it today.
Now, what really surprised me, and I guess it caught my attention last year, two of my favorite authors, Vince Flynn, geopolitical thriller writer, and Tom Clancy, both died within 6 weeks of each other, prostate cancer. In the case of Vince Flynn, he was, I think, age 44. Tom Clancy in his mid-60s. And Tom had heart bypass surgery, but you would think these prominent men would have gotten medical attention and this would have been detected.
Yeah, you'd like to assume that. But in fact, ironically, there seems to be more of an emphasis now of downplaying the role of the PSA. As I mentioned, the PSA is a simple blood marker. It's not always definitive, but it's a good indicator. And you begin watching the PSA trend, and as it begins going up, then you begin to put your feelers out there, and at the appropriate time, you may even need to do a biopsy, depending upon the doctor that you have or the urologist and how aggressive he is. Unfortunately, many people, when they go through the biopsy, they're getting 6 or 8 biopsies, and it's like a needle in the haystack. The more aggressive physicians will have anywhere from 12 to 18 or even 20, and then they give you a pretty good spectrum of what's happening there. But the two men that you mentioned there, I mean, without knowing anything about their medical background, unfortunately, somebody should have picked that up. But you're probably aware of the fact that there's been a real emphasis in downplaying certain tests, the PSA, the mammograms, and so forth. I'm sure that there are many men that have been treated for prostate cancer that had nothing been done, they could have lived the rest of their life and died from something else. The day will be coming when we can test an individual and determine which cancer is the more aggressive form and which is the indolent form. Right now, we don't have that ability. And prostate cancer is a very painful death. People can identify it, and there's different methods out there. Some people will have an active surveillance and kind of watch it if it begins going up. We've treated a number of men here that were on the active surveillance program, and then a period of 6 months or 12 months later, they went back and did some more checking and found out that the PSA had not only jumped, but so had the Gleason score. And the Gleason score is an indication of how aggressive the cancer is. But the time will be coming in the future that we'll be able to identify which person that's got the cancer, which type of cancer that he has, whether it's aggressive or whether it's very slow growing. And the slow growing kind, a person can go along with that and end up dying from something else many, many, many years later and experience a great quality of life. But we don't have that ability just yet.
So your advice usually is once a man turns age 50, he should have his PSA checked each year. For example, when he goes in for a physical, if you've had prostate cancer in the family, maybe a man in his 40s may want to start checking it. In the case of Vince Flynn, he actually died at age 44. So those are two recommendations you would broadly recommend.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend if there's prostate cancer in the family, if a man had a father or an uncle or some brothers that had it, then, you know, you need to begin watching it. And particularly the sons, if their fathers had it, probably in the mid-40s, they need to begin watching and just kind of establish a trend. And it's a lot easier to catch it at that point. There are some additional sophisticated tests out there now, in addition to the PSA, that people can conduct in addition to the PSA or in addition to the biopsy. There is a PC3, which is a very sophisticated test where the man has the prostate massaged, and then there is a urine test, and then there is a barometer there, kind of a graduated scale, and you can determine there whether there's something going on, and that may lead to a biopsy again.
What about things like prostate MRIs and ultrasound, color Doppler? There are other forms of detection, are there not?
Yeah, fortunately, there's a lot more here, even in the last couple of years, that can enable a person to really identify what is going on there. One of the things, Jim, that I emphasize to our patients is that, you know, identifying the disease is one thing, being treated for the disease is another thing. And as I mentioned, proton is one of the many, many areas of being treated out there. I just returned from Washington, D.C. in an NAPT conference, National Association of Proton Therapy, and discovered, to my surprise, that there's far more centers out there than I was even aware of. I know we've got about 15 right here in the United States now that are currently operating, but there's another 15 or 20 on the drawing board. Some within the next few years are going to be operating. When we have our patients come in, and I meet with them each week during an orientation process, I first of all welcome them because they're sober, they've got cancer, they know other people that have had cancer, and they're very fearful of the whole experience. And I often ask them, what's the first thing you think of when you hear those words, you have cancer? And 95% will quickly respond, I'm dying. How long do I have? Will it be painful? Will I see my grandkids? Will I have any grandkids? And it's a very frightening experience. I mean, 95% will quickly respond that way. So I'll begin by saying, I want to begin with wonderful news. I tell them they're in the best possible place on planet Earth to be treated for their cancer. We've been doing it for over 24 years. And treated 17,500 patients. When we first got started, we were treating one or two type of cancers. Now we're treating over 200 different tumor sites. And of all those tumors, probably close to 70% of those in the past have been prostate cancer. But as I continue visiting with the patients, I say, you know, I got wonderful news. You're in the best possible place. And then I'll ask them, is anything 100%? And they think I'm talking about the treatment. And they'll say no, and I'll repeat it again. I said, is anything 100%? And they'll still say no. Finally, I'll repeat it, and somebody said, well, death and taxes. Well, you can really get away with the taxes, but everybody still dies. So the question isn't whether we're going to die. The real question is, how are we going to live? And that's where Loma Linda comes in with its emphasis on whole person care. Loma Linda is a religious institution. It's a Seventh-day Adventist institution. And somebody will respond, oh, yeah, we know about you, Adventists. We've been over your temple there and listened to your choir over there in Salt Lake. And then everybody will laugh and they'll say, no, that's our friends, the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. Seventh-day Adventists are in the healing ministries. We have hospitals and medical clinics all around the world. We've been here at Loma Linda for over 100 years. And one of the undergirding philosophies of Loma Linda and the Seventh-day Adventist Church is to make man whole, mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally. And that's why we believe that even though Loma Linda is only one of 125 health science centers in the country, and we're one of 15 or 18 proton centers, what's always going to separate Loma Linda is its emphasis on whole person care, mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally. And we have a variety of programs to assist in that. I tell our patients that no matter what type of tumor they're being treated for, particularly prostate, the treatments take place in the gantry or in the fixed beam line. That's where the protons are delivered. But healing is a process, much more than just showing up for the treatment. And we don't think it makes any sense for us to successfully treat somebody for their cancer only to hear a year or two later that they died of a heart attack or of a massive stroke because of imbalance in their life. So we're going to be treating the whole person. We talk about diet and exercise and nutrition and rest. And we talk about a word in the dictionary that's very easy to spell, balance, but very hard to incorporate in the overall life. And so we have a whole variety of programs, educational programs, nutritional programs. And we have a wellness center, which is our Drayson Center, over 140,000 square feet, but we've got two large heated pools. We've got racquetball courts, tennis courts, a beautiful Nautilus, and we expect our patients to use that 3 to 5 times a week as part of the healing process. Every Tuesday night, we have a potluck by the patients, for the patients. There's a psychosocial dynamic that takes place where these patients get together and they become a part of their own support system. Every Wednesday night, we have an educational support group where we bring in some of our professors here at the university and speak about a wide variety of programs, including cancer-fighting foods. Then on Thursday night, we have our patients involved in a restaurant tour where every Thursday we go to a different restaurant. So there's a variety of programs here that all contribute to the healing process. And these prostate patients, you know, they may be here for 9 weeks for treatment, but it's amazing to see the transformation that takes place when they come in quite fearful. They've got cancer. They've known other people that have had cancer. And by the time they're getting middle of the way through the process here, they begin talking about this radiation vacation that they're on. And they even kid each other by saying, hey, don't tell the people back home what's going on because they're going to quit sending you cards and flowers and praying for you in one thing or another. It's kind of a joke among the patients about this radiation vacation that they're on.
Doctor, let me ask you a couple questions. Usually when somebody's diagnosed with prostate cancer, the two common cures are usually surgery. And in the area of surgery now, one aspect of surgery is like the Da Vinci machine. And the other is radiation. Let's talk about the different therapies and approaches and contrast them, and then also talk about proton beam radiation and distinguish that between regular radiation.
Yeah, there's probably at least 3 different modalities that are being treated out there. The most common is surgery, and there's the traditional surgery as well as the newer robotic surgery. And then there are various forms of radiation. There's traditional radiation, which is regular photons. And then there's more recently, during the last few years, there's a new form called IMRT, intentionally moderated radiation therapy. It's more focused, it's more precise. And there's also cryo, which is a freezing. So that's one of the other areas. Loma Linda is the first place actually in the world where proton was used to begin treating tumors in a clinical setting. Protons have been used for many, many years, but here at Loma Linda was the first place in the world, and now they have them, as I mentioned, all across this country, over in Asia and in Europe. They're talking about getting them in Australia, but it all began right here at Loma Linda. And the difference between a photon, which is traditional x-rays, and a proton, photons enter the body, and a lot of the energy is released upon entering the body, actually before it gets to the tumor. Then it hits the tumor and then proceeds out the other way. If you have a watch on, and you're looking at the watch, and if photons or traditional x-rays come in from the left side of your wrist, hit the watch area, which is where the tumor is, and then it goes out the other side. In contrast to a photon, which is another particle, but it has an energy and it has what they call the Bragg peak. It's a physical phenomena where it can stop with pinpoint accuracy. Very little of the energy is released as it enters into the skin. It hits the tumor and then it ends with pinpoint accuracy right on the end of the tumor. I mean, we're treating eye, brain, spine. We're treating, as I mentioned, over 200 different tumor sites. But the ability of the proton to precisely target it and minimize any kind of collateral damage is absolutely amazing. That's what it makes it really the ideal technology for the 21st century. I mean, whether you're talking about a cyber knife or a Tobo knife or Calypso, they're all forms of photon. They all have an entrance dose and they all have an exit dose in contrast to proton therapy. And that's why more and more people are investing in the technology. Now, Mayo just recently announced here within the last year that they're building two proton centers, investing almost $600 million, one up in Rochester and the other one down in Scottsdale, Arizona. And MD Anderson has one now. And more and more of the health science institutions are getting them across the country because they realize it is the most specific targeted type of treatment for dealing with various types of cancer. And as I mentioned, you know, when we started 24 years ago, we were treating only one or two type of tumors, but we're dealing with all kinds of clinical trials right now. We have a clinical trial for breast cancer. Women have been treated for breast cancer for many, many years, traditionally about 40 x-rays. The problem in the past has been the tumor is taken care of, but later on, these women can have a problem with either the heart or the lungs because the x-rays or the photons have gone all the way through. We started a clinical trial little over 5 years ago now. We're in the second phase for women with early stage breast cancer with a lumpectomy with 10 proton treatments. And the first 50 went through the 5-year cycle, and I think 47 or 48 of them had no cancer whatsoever. One had cancer in another spot. So instead of getting the 40 radiation, they're getting 10 proton treatments. We have a clinical trial with early stage liver cancer. We're doing liver metastasis now in a clinical trial. We're doing a clinical trial with esophageal cancer, early stage lung cancer, 10 treatments. One of the things they're working on right now with the government defense department are these men that are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and they've had an arm blown off or leg blown off and have this phantom pain. And they're convinced that if they can identify the pain pathways and hit it with proton, they'll be able to solve the problem. Epilepsy is going to be one of the next things that they're going to be addressing. So there's some real exciting things going on in the area of proton therapy and the research that's going on. Dr. Slater, who's the genius that started this, had a physics background, then went into radiation medicine. He's still involved in research. His eyes light up as he begins thinking about the different prospects. He thinks we've only begun to touch the prospects and the possibilities of what protons can do in addressing some of the needs of today.
Now, is proton therapy starting to catch on? I know here locally in San Diego, Scripps announced that they had built one.
Just opened up. And as I mentioned, there's probably 15. I just came back this last week from Washington, D.C., and there's probably 15 or 18 more on the drawing board, some that'll be opening up in the next year or two, all across the country. Not only is it getting more popular, there's all kinds of research going on and clinical trials going on that's going to revolutionize the way some cancers that, you know, a few years ago was a death sentence, and now people are going to realize when they get it, it's only a diagnosis and it can be treated.
Why don't you contrast this proton radiation with regular radiation in terms of side effects and the side effects compared to surgery? I know men that have had surgery, I've read that they have incontinence problems, there's ED problems, there's various other aspects that you have in terms of side effects. Contrast that to proton in terms of side effects.
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up. If you had three men and all three men were treated for prostate cancer and one of them had surgery, one of them had traditional radiation, one had proton, there's no question that the person that had the proton would have minimal side effects. The one that had the radiation could have some side effects a little bit later on, could be some rectal bleeding problems or some other side effects. The one that has surgery, all the evidence indicates from the research that's been presented recently that it almost appears like there's a greater disappointment with the robotic surgery because I think there's a greater expectation that they're not going to have some of the same problems. But there is still a high percentage that have ED and have incontinence. Now, there are many men that go through surgery and they don't have any of these problems. And some men, when they are confronted with the fact that they've got prostate cancer, they want to get it out of there and get out of there and move on with their lives. Unfortunately, sometimes the surgery removes the prostate but doesn't get all of the tumor. And in terms of making a contrast, again, that's one of the advantages of proton. Surgery will remove the prostate. The prostate's approximately the size of a walnut, and it removes it. However, if somebody's going to have cancer and it's going to be more aggressive, it's going to be around the perimeter, around the border. And if you just remove the prostate, you're not going to get that. And with protons, there's a margin around the area that is covered with the protons. And people want to know, what about, you know, if you got a prostate, is it just in one area? Well, when we treat a prostate, it's kind of like you're painting the entire prostate back and forth for the full 45 days. We do have a clinical trial now going on for 20 days. When I came here 14 years ago, men were getting 38 treatments, then it moved to 40, then to 42, then to 45. 45 seems to be the maximum number of treatments with the minimum side effects. But we've got a clinical trial now, 20 days. When they come in for the 20-day treatment, they're hit from both sides in contrast to the 45 where every other day they're hit. I suspect that in the future, it's going to be 20 days or 15 days. You know, the idea is to maximize the dosage, minimize the side effects, and minimize the number of treatments. So in the future, it could be we're treating 20 right now, and I think we're in the second phase of that. The evidence looks very, very promising for continuing and maybe even eliminating a few more days of treatment. You know, when a man has to talk about 45 days, for some people, that seems like a long time. In contrast to people that are in and out with quick treatment, but then they live the rest of their life with some of the side effects from that treatment.
Doctor, what about the success rate? Because when you read about prostate cancer, surgery was considered the gold standard. How would you compare, let's say, surgery and the success rate of proton?
I agree. The term is gold standard, surgery being the gold standard. I kind of kid people. I said, well, you know, that was coined back in the 20th century. We're in the 21st century, and we have a platinum standard. It's called proton. I think as proton becomes more and more a viable option, that it's going to be rising right to the forefront as the first choice for treating prostate cancer. But again, it's coming, it's more and more prevalent, and as it becomes more prevalent, when people are given the choice, I think they're going to end up making the choice of choosing proton therapy because of the phenomenal results. If you take three different people and treat them, and all things being considered equal, the cancer will be treated in all three cases, whether it's surgery or radiation or proton. But the big difference, Jim, is in the side effects that people sometimes live with for the rest of their life. In contrast to proton, they do invest 9 weeks of being treated, but they have the rest of their life where they've got quality of life. And more today, people are interested in the quality of life issues. These are the big issues. Getting treated is one thing. Getting rid of the tumor is another thing. But living with some of these side effects for the rest of your life does affect the quality of your life. And that's where proton makes all the difference in the world. Non-invasive, and these people that are here and being treated are able to call it a radiation vacation.
Doctor, do you think eventually that proton will replace regular beam radiation therapy?
No, I don't think it'll ever completely replace it. It'll be far more prominent in the future than it is today. There's a growing awareness of it now and appreciation for it. And a lot of very, very exciting clinical trials going on that's going to open up the pathway for even far more exciting treatments in the future.
Doctor, how can a man, let's say you go to a doctor, you're diagnosed with prostate cancer, not just being diagnosed can be a major problem and trauma for an individual. Nobody wants to hear the C word mentioned by a doctor, but really finding out the best forms of treatment. Is there a book out there? Is there something that a man can go to understand what are the steps after the PSA? Should you have a biopsy? What is a Gleason score? All these kind of things that come into play that really can inform a patient so he can make, or even a woman, when it comes to breast cancer, can make the best decision.
Well, I'm glad you've asked that question. Fortunately, today, even in the last 10 years, there are multiple books out there. A person can go online, check out prostate cancer, and there are multiple websites will begin to appear. One of the more popular books out of the really thousands of books out there on prostate cancer, one of the more popular books is a book written by Robert Marchini, former CEO of an executive company back east. He's actually back in the Boston area, but he was diagnosed with prostate cancer and ended up writing a book from a layman's perspective, describing this process that he went through. And I think most of the proton centers across the country are now using that book. It's Robert Marchini, You Can Survive Prostate Cancer, and then in small caps, Without Surgery. And he goes step by step in a very methodical way. He's with an engineering background. He's very methodical. And he's had all kinds of professional scientific help in reviewing the book before it actually came out to print. And there's tens of thousands of those books now all across North America. I think it's one of the most popular books if you go onto Amazon. Robert Marchini, You Can Survive Prostate Cancer. And most of the patients, when they come here and they said they've read the book, it says, you know, it described the very experience that they were going through and step by step, identifying the different steps, what to look for, the type of questions to ask. And really, it's just kind of a primer for people that have been diagnosed with prostate cancer. You can get it online. You can go on a website, go on to Amazon.com and get a copy of it. But Mr. Marchini has done an outstanding job of writing a book that's provided help for thousands upon thousands of people, really all around the world. From what I understand, there are people all around the world that have read that book and have chosen their type of treatment based upon reading the book.
Well, listen, Doctor, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the therapy and the treatment of proton beam at Loma Linda, how could they do so, please?
Well, all they need to do, first of all, Loma Linda's got a website. We're here located in Loma Linda, California. But 1-800-PROTONS will do it, and you can get here. And if anybody would like to give me a call, I'm always available. My office number is 909-558-4501. And it's really been great to visit with you. And for our listening audience, there are many options out there, but you seriously need to consider looking at proton for any type of cancer treatment that you might encounter.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show and talking about a very important subject. As I mentioned, statistically, 233,000 new cases of prostate cancer are diagnosed each year, and over 29,000 men die of it each year. 1 out of 7 during your lifetime, 6 out of 10 over age 65. Hopefully, they'll find this interview helpful. Doctor, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was a rather interesting interview. Why I wanted to have Dr. Lynn Martell here, it really impacted me last year. This is a disease that, if caught early enough, is preventable. And two of my favorite authors, Vince Flynn, who passed away from prostate cancer at age 44, very tragic. In fact, in one of his last books, he talked about he was experiencing pain 2 years before he was diagnosed when he would sit down to write. He couldn't sit down and write for more than an hour or two at a time. I always wondered why his doctor did not pick up on that. And then, of course, Tom Clancy, one of my other favorite authors, too. Both men, 6 weeks within each other. So I thought it was rather interesting because this is a disease, even though it's common, it's probably the second leading cause of death among men. It is preventable. And hopefully, if you listen to this interview, if you're in your 40s and you have a history of it in your family, or you're over age 50, you'll start taking precaution and include a PSA count in your annual physical. On behalf of Kaplan Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you here for joining us on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk. We'll be right back.